James and Carla Murray began documenting New York City's oldest and most interesting Manhattan business storefronts more than 25 years ago using a 35mm camera and film. They were on our show in 2011 to discuss the first book to emerge from that project. It was called Simply Storefront, and it quickly became a bestseller. They're back today to talk about a follow-up to that book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved, The Disappearing Face of New York. It's a gorgeous coffee table book published by the Ginkgo Press that weighs more than 7 pounds and includes photographs and texts about storefronts in all five boroughs. And I'm very pleased that it brings James and Carla Murray back to our show today. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And yes, thank you.
And later in the segment, we will invite calls with questions or suggestions about especially interesting storefronts from our listeners, things that you think might interest the Murrays, especially in the outer boroughs. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Your first storefronts book was published in two versions, a heavy coffee table book like this one, and then a smaller, more portable book someone could carry around. Are there plans to bring out a smaller version of this book as well?
Definitely, but we have to sell through this first print run first.
Do your readers like to take the book? Well, they can't take this one in their pocket, but do they like to take the book with them and explore the city looking for these storefronts?
Definitely. That's why we came out with what we call the storefront mini version, because we got a lot of feedback from people that, you know, we put the addresses in for the stores purposely so people could go and visit them, but being 7 pounds, it was difficult to carry around, so it was always in our mind to have that miniature version.
Although there'll be a certain amount of disappointment when people go looking at some of these places, because many of these stores no longer exist. As I mentioned, James, you shot the photos for your first book using film, which you then had to have developed. So are you doing all digital now?
Yeah, we've made the transition to digital. Just because the speed we needed for turnaround, it got harder and harder for us to find a timely place to develop the film.
The labs have all disappeared along with the storefronts?
Exactly.
Right. There's a couple left, but it was more like the project became a race against time because they were disappearing so fast that if we didn't get that photo that day, we couldn't be certain that we could easily go back to it and photograph it. So it was necessitated the digital, because then we could be sure we got the photograph. You know, we would review it right on the spot.
Did you gain other advantages by using digital? Last time you were here, you told me that you had to rent space to store all your photographs. Digital is a lot easier to store.
It is in a way, but we do have a lot of hard drives, so we need space for those as well.
Some photographers love film the way some music lovers love vinyl. Were there things that you could do with film that you can't do digitally, or vice versa?
Well, we still use film. I mean, I guess you could say it has to be film-worthy. So when we photograph a store, we'll bring two cameras with us. We'll bring our digital, but we'll also bring the film.
And what do you get from each?
The film, I guess, we really like the patina. And we like that we're using that older format because the stores are older, too. So it just kind of, I don't know, some inherent, what would you say, James?
Yeah, the digital, though, gives a sharpness that a lot of people demand now and expect. Like, we like Carla said, that grain and the depth the film gives you and that kind of analog feel. But more and more people are saying, oh, you know, can we get this on digital? We like it, like, almost crystal clear, like, almost plastic looking.
But most people are going to see these photographs in a book form.
Sure.
So do they translate equally well into winding up being done photo offset?
Well, definitely the first film, the book, first storefront book being entirely film, it was more time consuming because each one had to be scanned in order to make the book. I mean, we had to scan the photos, so there was that extra step involved. And even scanning, I mean, unfortunately, we have a dog, and we had a dog at that time as well. And, you know, he shakes and his little hair goes all over the place, and we're always panicking that it's going to get on our film. So it's, you know, it's definitely difficult. Having the digital made it easier in that we didn't have to worry so much about that and, you know, cleaning up the photos.
What criteria do you use when you're deciding which storefronts you'll photograph? Are you especially attracted to storefronts with interesting signage or the ones that look like they've remained unchanged for years?
Definitely. We really were always a fans of typography and the different lettering. We like the hand-painted lettering, or the hand-painted signs. We like love old neon signs. So we were definitely attracted to those kind of storefronts that had interesting signage, but also the displays that they had, like in their window, which is kind of like an old-fashioned thing. A lot of new modern stores, they don't spend the time making interesting window displays. It kind of fell out of favor. I mean, the whole thing of window dressers and people spending, you know, an inordinate amount of time, you know, redoing their windows every month. So we like that as well.
Does it help if there's a good story connected with a particular business or a shop?
Of course. I mean, for us, the project became equally important to have an interesting story as far as the store owner was concerned and what they had to say about their store, like how many years it's been in business and what was the secret to their success and things like that, are just interesting things that they had to relate about the business. Yeah, but it was still very visually driven as well.
I invited calls, and we have a really interesting call from Deborah from Newark, New Jersey. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm very excited to hear about your project and at this, the level at which you're doing it. I would love to see you tracking the storefront churches of the five boroughs, because there are thousands of them, and they're everywhere, and they're hidden away. I'm sure you had to block out storefront churches as you focused on individual storefronts you were photographing. And the reason I'm so interested in this is I had opportunity in the late 80s and early 90s of working with a documentary photographer in Appalachia, and we photographed thousands of storefront churches throughout central Appalachia, eastern Kentucky, southwest Virginia, southern West Virginia, east Tennessee, western North Carolina. And it did become a book of 350 photos, but that's not my interest. My interest is you're doing this project and tracking the storefront churches, photographing them in the five boroughs of Manhattan. Of New York City.
Okay, so Deborah, do you know anybody who's willing to pay for this project and allow the Murrays
to do it? I had to dig up grants myself through nonprofits and through foundations to be able to finance it. And truthfully, the photographer I worked with did a lot of it pro bono out of his own pocket, but this is in the 80s and early 90s.
Now, in the case of this book, you had to finance it all yourself?
Right. The project was a real labor of love. We, you know, we never thought to make a book, in all honesty. We were just collecting them because we loved them so much, and it was just, you know, our own, like, personal pet project. And then we collected so many of them. What happened, actually, one day was our editor had come over because we were publishing a book on graffiti art at the time, and we had some of these storefront photos up on our wall. And he came over, and he's like, what are those? And we're like, oh, those are, you know, some stores. We didn't think anyone else was interested in looking at pictures of storefronts, to be honest. And he's like, oh, those are great. How many do you have? And we're like, oh, my God, you know, yeah, how many? That's an understatement.
Then we pulled
go ahead, James.
No, then we pulled out a box of the little analog cassette tapes of the interviews. And he's like, oh, my God, you have the interviews, too. And it was really neat.
Right. So he kind of planted the seed in our mind that we could make a book project. And you know, that's how it grew from there. And then, of course, the second storefront book, you know, we always had in mind that we would continue the story, because we couldn't fit all the things that we wanted to in the first storefront book.
Well, I'd imagine there are an awful lot of people who look at these pictures and say, oh, my God, that's my history. I used to go to that store. Whatever happened to it? This is preserving the history of many neighborhoods, especially this one, which covers all five boroughs, and tells the story of 40, 50 years, sometimes even more, of a street. The book is called Storefront 2, A History Preserved, The Disappearing Face of New York, done by James T. and Carla L. Murray, and printed by Ginkgo Press in gorgeous, very large edition. As we said, not only photographs, but also the stories of some of these things. How did you work with that? Did you get in touch with the business owners, or did they all want to talk about their experiences?
Pretty much what we found is when we would photograph the store, we would go inside and see if the owner was around, tell them, you know, we're going to take a photo of the outside of your store, and then say, oh, if you have some time, we would like to ask you a few questions. And we found early on in the project that, you know, we first started with a little video camera, that wasn't going to work, that people felt very self-conscious about it, and sometimes the store owner would be like, oh, no, I want to go home and change.
Yeah, let me shave.
Yeah, fix my hair or wear a different outfit. So we quickly scrapped that idea and we said, okay, we're going to just use like this little micro cassette recorder because digital, you know, didn't exist back in the 90s when we started this. So we just used that tiny little digital recorder. I mean, now we use an analog recorder with a little tiny micro cassette tape, but now we use a digital one because it's just easier for transcription. But when we started asking them questions, they were so nice, and we couldn't believe it. I mean, sometimes we would spend hours with them. They really were happy to tell us, you know, the intricacies of their store.
You note in your introduction that 2/3 of the storefronts you included in your first book no longer exist. Also, 25 of the storefronts you included in New York Nights, a book of photos that you shot at night that was published in 2012, have also disappeared since. Had you known or at least suspected before you took these photos that these businesses were in danger of closing?
Well, that was really the whole reason what prompted us to keep on documenting, because we did notice that they were disappearing, but it wasn't as fast a rate as it is now. I mean, it was more like, okay, if we didn't get the photo, we weren't that concerned. Like, we'd write it down and, you know, we'd go back another month, or, you know, maybe a couple of months would go by. But now it's such a fast pace, these closures. And I mean, especially when the store owner does not own the building that they're located
in. And many of the owners you spoke with told you that they'd only been able to stay in business because they'd owned the building. They told you that their father or their grandfather had bought the building 50 or 100 years ago, and that's what had allowed them to stay. So what happens to businesses that are forced out of these locations? Are they likely to move to a new location, or is that it?
Sometimes yes, but oftentimes no, because they can't find anything in the neighborhood. If they want to stay in the neighborhood, they've become priced out. So it's a big problem.
And then I'm assuming that many of the stores close, because the owner's children don't want to take them over. The children are better educated than their parents were, and they become professionals. They don't want to have to get up at 4 a.m. to start making bagels.
Yeah, they've created a better life for their kids. And like you said, a lot of them are doctors and lawyers, and they didn't want that life of, you know, they work 80 hours a week, some of these guys and women, and it's just a hard life.
Right, especially like in the food industry and like baking business in particular, because you have to get up so early and you know, prepare. There's so much preparation involved, as well as the long hours of being in the store. So some of them told us, oh, I don't want my children to take over the business. But on the flip side, there's a store that I can think of, Caputo's Bake Shop, which is in Carroll Gardens. And the fifth generation owner, you know, had a nice education. He had a successful job on Wall Street. And then when his father said he was going to get ready to retire and close, you know, close shop, that the son quit his job on Wall Street and rejoined the baking business. So it's a nice story.
And we have heard similar things about other stores that have been included in other books, like Russ and Daughters, DePaulo's, where people realized that the family business was important to them, so they gave up their Wall Street or other things that they were doing.
Exactly. Yes, that's definitely the case with Nikki.
Let's take a call from Alan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air. Hello,
Thank
Alan.
You. I'm right here.
Go ahead.
As a category, along with storefront designs, we've lost a lot of modest sit-down eateries, diners in the lower Manhattan area, like Ellen's from City Hall vicinity that was closed after 9/11. There used to be a Monterey Diner near the courthouses in lower Manhattan. And many of these places that you wouldn't find in a guide of tourist eateries, but were good places for people to sit down, read the paper, get ready to go to work and have conversations with people nearby who are also sitting down for more than the time it takes to grab a disposable plastic salad or a paper cup of coffee. And it seems that a lot of the pop-up community potential of the city has been lost.
Are they being replaced by Starbucks?
Well, we've definitely documented many little coffee
yeah,
shops.
Cup and Saucer on the
right
side.
Right, Cup and Saucer is in our storefront too book, and in New York Nights we had a lot of different restaurants and diners, and I can think of, in fact, La Taz de Oro in Chelsea just recently closed. That's in our storefront too book, and that was a specialized in Puerto Rican cuisine. And sadly, they own the building, but their gas was turned off, and they just had problems with it, you know, getting turned back on, and they just finally decided to close the business.
Yeah, and B&H Dairy.
Right, they
had another nice little counter with stools that's
right.
still out there.
Yeah, they had problems too with the gas
because of that explosion.
Exactly, because right. they were
it
just
took
a few
lot longer to get back in business
right.
than they had expected.
Right, and Stage, like kind of directly across the street, is still closed to this day. So it's we definitely losing those. And yes, sometimes it's replaced by, you know, a Starbucks or something like that. I mean, Bleecker Street Records, for instance, got replaced by a Starbucks right on Bleecker Street. Luckily, they found another location nearby, but still, they really wanted to stay on Bleecker Street.
My guests are James and Carla Murray. Their latest book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved, The Disappearing Face of New York, is published by Ginkgo Press. And we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with James T. and Carla L. Murray. Their latest book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved, The Disappearing Face of New York, published by Ginkgo Press. Your first storefront book included some panoramic photographs of streets where all the stores were still mom-and-pop businesses with no chain stores. But you haven't included any panorama photos in this book. Is do commercial streets without chain stores or new high-rises no longer exist in New York?
Yeah, we couldn't find them.
Right. It was just too difficult to find, like, that row after row after row of uninterrupted mom-and-pop stores.
Although these storefronts are often torn down to make way for new buildings, don't they sometimes just sit empty for years?
Definitely. That's a big problem. I mean, especially here in the village, in this very same, you know, neighborhood where the studio is, there's many, many empty storefronts simply because they're asking so much rent. I mean, it's such
high
rent.
And a landlord would rather have them sit empty than have a business thriving in their store?
Yeah, the cover of our first book, Ralph's Discount City, is still empty 7 years later.
Right.
7, 8 years. It's been empty that whole time.
So, yes, I mean, that's what it seems like. It seems like, I guess, they're taking a tax write-off. I'm not really sure, but definitely they're staying empty for a long time.
Well, what's happening to storefronts in designated historic districts? Are they protected in any way from demolition or redevelopment?
I mean, as far as we know, the storefronts, there's no protection right now. I mean, you know, we would love for the city to afford some protection for these small businesses, but right now there's no, you know, help with lease negotiations, there's nothing. And those kind of rules that other places are doing could definitely help. Like in
right.
San Francisco, they have rules that regulate that.
But if the store owner wants to continue business there, he has some protection or some backing to do that.
But here, that's not the case. If the landlord says...
right, if they're not renewing your lease or they're, you know, tripling it, quadrupling it, or, you know, 20 times the amount, I mean, there's just ridiculous astronomical increases that they're doing.
Giovanni from the West Village. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. On great segment, by the way. I'm going to go check out these images right away. On 14th Street and 8th Avenue, there is a fantastic retro dinosaur display sign that has no longer serving the store it once pointed to. It's a two-story liquor display that's probably part neon, part
yeah, the
old.
Yellow one?
Yeah, we know exactly.
Yeah, my guests are both nodding their heads.
Yeah, the tall yellow. It's like two and a half stories.
I'm wondering what goes through your spirit and your mind when you see a magnificent sign that is no longer pointing to a store.
Yeah, we're running to get a ladder.
Yeah, and I'm wondering who owns that sign. Is it does the building own it? Can they do what they want with it? Is it part of their structure?
I think that it's part of when you sign a lease, I think there's probably negotiations regarding that, because oftentimes the signs are left behind. And it's a big deal to take them down, because if you take them down, a sign can't go back up in its place that's big and overhanging like that, because the city has new rules and regulations in effect that you can't have such a large overhanging sign like that one, for instance. It can't hang more than, I believe it's like 16 inches from the, you know, the face of the building. So if it hangs
outside of Times Square, right?
Right, and outside of Times Square, it's difficult to get neon permits as well. So I think that's why the building owners leave those in place, because in case a different storefront owner wants to, you know, repurpose the sign or something like that, change the lettering, but actually leave the sign in place, and they can still use the existing permit for the sign.
Yeah, an example of that is like Carbone's, right,
Greenwich Village. Rocco Ristorante was an old Italian restaurant in the village, and when they went out of business, I mean, actually, the business owner really did want to stay, but unfortunately, you know, he lost in lease negotiations. They wanted to raise the rent too high. The place that took it over now, which is called Carbone's, it's like a, you know, more of a high-end restaurant, you could say, and they repurposed the sign, so they put Carbone on the Rocco Ristorante neon.
You've said that you like to check up on the stores that you photograph. Do you feel a sense of loss when they're gone, or is that just what life in New York City is all about?
Oh, an extreme sense of loss. I mean, sometimes we've become really great friends with the store owner, not only in our own neighborhood, because we live in the East Village and we've lived in the same apartment for over 20 years now. So we, you know, definitely, you know, developed a relationship with the store owners by us, but it's in these outer boroughs. We still stay in touch with the store owners. Oftentimes they call us.
And their relatives email us a lot of times. Like in one instance, the woman was forced to close. This was in Bed-Stuy.
Right, Katie's Candy. It's the back cover of our storefront book.
And then it was her relative.
Her son.
Her son emailed us and said that like 6 months after her store was taken away from her, she passed away. And that he feels that it was what was holding her together and keeping her going.
Right, when she didn't have that place to go to every day because, you know, she had lost her husband and the store was really everything to her. And when she didn't have that anymore, she, you know, quickly became ill and
yeah, there's been instances
away.
We actually, me and Carla, felt like taking over the business. We got so involved with there was a pork store in the Belmont section of the Bronx, the Little Italy section. And we really got so invested in the gentleman's story. And he was the only one making this particular type of Italian sausage. And he had no one in his family. He wasn't a marrying type, he said, and he didn't have any kids. And he had just gotten too old, and the rent's gotten too high. And we were like, God, we really felt moved to almost say, let's learn. Hey, teach us. We'll do it.
Now, let's talk a bit about the Bronx, because the first book was pretty much all Manhattan. This book is dominated by Brooklyn. There are some photos from the Bronx, from Queens and Staten Island. But is that because there aren't all that many storefronts still extant in Staten Island, the Bronx, and Queens, or because Brooklyn is just more photogenic?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Definitely the Bronx, the biggest problem is in the South Bronx. A lot of the old storefronts got decimated. Hmm. I mean, you know, with the whole blight that happened in the late 70s, the buildings got, you know, trashed. They got burned. And the businesses with them. So there's not as many as compared
right,
to...
Right, there's just smaller pockets.
Right.
And since you're thinking very much in terms of neighborhoods in the way you've structured these books, finding a neighborhood with a lot of stores is the ideal situation for you?
Definitely, but we like to, I mean, we've grouped it into neighborhoods, and this time we've grouped it into adjoining neighborhoods just to give us more leeway, because sometimes we'll just find one store left in a particular neighborhood. Now, that's not a big enough, you know, we can't devote a whole mm-hmm. section of the book to just one store, so we tried to group
like
it into adjoining neighborhoods.
Cullen's Tavern up on White Plains Road.
Right, that was in Wakefield.
It's an Irish bar, and he said there used to be how many Irish bars?
He said like a dozen Irish bars, like within, you know,
a
couple of blocks, and then he's the only one left. So we felt it was important to include little places like that, but, you know, it's harder and harder to find many, many stores in the same
neighborhood. Are they all being replaced by chain stores?
I mean, sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes it is another mom-and-pop business, but the mom-and-pop business to us doesn't visually look appealing to photograph. Like, they don't take the time to put, a hand-painted sign. They'll just put up a little plastic banner, and it doesn't show much of individuality and creativity.
Yeah, there's not the sense of permanence that that these guys would put up their huge, like we were mentioning to the caller, the huge 2.5-story neon sign. And that was a sign to us that they care and that they're going to be there for a while. Like, there's one running still by in our neighborhood, Venerio's. Right. And he says that his sign is his whole thing. When he first started the business, they didn't have email. They didn't have batch email or mailings about the business. They just had their sign in front of their footprint of the store. So the appearance of the store to these guys was everything. And now you see a much more like almost transient when you say hun, like appearance.
Right. Maybe they're – and part of it is because the store owners can't get long-term leases. I mean, it used to be that you could sign a 30-year lease. You can't – no one's giving anybody a 30-year lease anymore. So now you can sign a year or two lease, so you really don't have the permanence.
And if you're a success, that actually is an inducement for the landlord to jack up your rent.
Exactly.
There are a lot of married professional photographers, but not many who work together. How do you divvy up the work?
Well, I mean, we both take the photographs. I do all the interviews just because we found early on with the project that the people just opened up more to me as a woman, I guess, than a man. They felt more self-conscious, I guess, when James was around.
Yeah, I would drift back in because, like Carla said earlier, we'd spend like 4 hours at a place just kind of not being disruptive to the business. And the owners would just talk to us over their shoulder. But when I first started, it was they're rigid and uncomfortable, and it was much easier to talk to Carla. And then, like I said, I could drift back in once they got rolling and they saw that we were there, you know.
Right. And oftentimes we have our dog with us. So James would, you know, if it was a food business, he could just stay outside with the dog. And then James, as far as also we divide the work, he's the one that does all the Photoshop and all the post-processing on the computer with the photography.
Now, a lot of these photographs were taken within the last 5 years, and you have a beautiful two-page spread on Eagle Provisions, the Polish food store that was on Fifth Avenue and Park Slope in Brooklyn, although the owner told you that he'd resisted offers to sell that building for a long time. Hasn't it?
Yes,
gave it up in just a couple of years ago.
I think it was just this year, actually. I think it was earlier this year or as late 2014.
People love that store, and I'm sure that it was doing good business. What happens?
I mean, I think it was two brothers that owned that particular business, and the brother that we interviewed was the one really that didn't want to ever sell, and I think it was really the other brother who, you know, just didn't, you know, want to be a part of that. The whole food business, it's very, very difficult, very, very long hours.
But I think I read in the Times that somebody offered them a lot of money for the building, and even if you own the building and you want to keep it going, if somebody is throwing millions of dollars at you, do we know what's there now?
We haven't passed by, so I'm not sure.
No, I think I've seen pictures that's empty right now.
Yeah, I don't think it's a condo tower yet, but that's what we had heard.
He tells us a funny story in the book how they were giving buildings away in that neighborhood. Basically.
Right, that's how they owned the building because it was such a dilapidated neighborhood at one point.
Yeah, he said he used to go to his car at night after he locked up the store with one of the meat cleavers, carrying it to his car.
Right, and he said that when his father and he first had taken ownership of the store because it had been a Polish kielbasa place before then, that the mafia mailed him a body bag because they wanted, you know, to make sure that he would fit in it because they didn't keep on paying him off, you know, basically. They didn't give the mafia their weekly little envelope.
Let's take a call from Mary Beth from the Upper West Side. Hi, Mary Beth. Mary Beth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I lived at 83rd Street. I now live on 103rd Street, and I moved there in 1976 to 83rd. And I was wondering if you had photographed Zingoni's brothers. They're between 82nd and 83rd on Columbus Avenue. I have wonderful memories of bringing my children there, who are now 26 and 31, when they were toddlers. And Mrs. Zingoni would sit them on the counter. My son in particular would help push the cash register buttons, and they would even give me a break to run to the post office and leave my children in the store.
Oh, were you aware of the store?
I don't know why that doesn't ring a bell, that they're no longer there.
are there still, and it's been operating for three generations. And,
okay, the next book.
It's wonderful, and I hope you do visit them and photograph them.
Oh, definitely we will.
I assume that there will be more books along these lines. The last time you were here, you said you were going to do Chinatown, but you didn't do that. There are a lot of old buildings, and also, although the Chinatowns keep on changing, now you'd have three major Chinatowns to cover.
Right, and we have Flushing and the Chinatown in Brooklyn, and of course our own Chinatown right nearby the studios here.
We have a call from Jenny from Jackson Heights. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is such a great project, and I just wanted to mention that there is legislation in the City Council right now called the Small Business Job Survival Act, which would go some way to addressing this, what really is a crisis. New York City from 1945 to 63 had actual commercial rent control, and this bill is not that, but it would mandate a 10-year lease extension, give businesses the basic right to renew. And I was just curious if the guests are aware of this bill.
Oh, of course, yes. We've signed on as supporters of the bill, of course. We're well aware of it.
Yeah, we appreciate all the activists are doing,
right.
To stand behind these businesses. You have the Save NYC, and you have Take Back NYC, and
right. We support all these causes, but to us, the all these things of changing legislation, that takes time. And to us, the important thing is to actually go and, be a part of the community and frequent these small businesses, because they need your patronage.
And also they somehow symbolize a neighborhood. The cover photograph of this book is of Village Cigars and Sheridan Square. And I think for many people, that was what Sheridan Square looked like.
Exactly, exactly. We love that story that associated with Village Cigars because of that little triangular mosaic marker that's in front of it. If you see in mm-hmm. the picture, we included it because it has an interesting story in that the property was once owned by the Hess estate, a man who had a big five-story apartment building. And when the city came by and built the subway, the IRT line, they took away his building. And he was really upset that they took away his building, and he wouldn't give them this little 500-square-inch piece of property for them to create the sidewalk there on 7th Avenue. So he put that mosaic marker in place saying, this is property of the Hess estate.
The curator from the Interchurch Center at Riverside Church just called to say that they have you have several works in a show that they're exhibiting now called Gentrification. People can see that until January 4th. And, of course, there is this book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved, The Disappearing Face of New York by James T. and Carla L. Murray. It's published by Ginkgo Press. And, as always, it's a pleasure having you on our show, and it brings back so many memories of New York City for an old-timer like me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.